And now you can be seated and we hear from our favorite Aggie, Mr. Mendez.
Thank you, Mr. Guy. Good afternoon, everyone. Good to see all of you again. I must make a correction here. An Aggie is someone that's from Texas A&M College Station. So I am probably an adopted Aggie, but I'm not really an Aggie. I'm not good enough to be an Aggie, huh? Also, Mr. Myers was mentioning about the fact that it costs a lot of money to get me here. They wouldn't have been able to do it if my wife hadn't put in some money. Did you get her check? Did you get the check? Okay. But anyway, I've enjoyed being here. It's nice to meet brethren. No matter where you go, it's always good to be able to visit with people from different areas, and you always end up knowing somebody that's in the congregation, so it's very nice to be here with you. And once again, I'd like to thank everybody that was involved in helping me to arrive here and make sure that all these things were set up. Very, very pretty tablecloths and the animals that are set up here, very nice. So somebody really did a nice job on that, so I'd like to thank whoever was involved in all of that. I need to turn on my mic down here, don't I? How's that? You know, a common question that people are often asked is, where are you from? You know, people will ask, where are your parents from? Or they may ask, you know, where were you raised? Where were you born? We often have our friends that will ask us these things because we're all interested in origins. We're all interested in where we came from and where we've been and what we've done. And, you know, young people are very good at asking other young people where they're from and where they were raised. We adults sort of are a little bit more stoic and don't do that. But young people are very good at doing that. And I'd like to ask you a question along this vein. Where did the world come from? Where did the earth and all its different life forms come from? Where did we come from? Did they evolve? You know, is evolution the process that created us? Many people will tell you that it is. They'll often say that evolution is scientific. Is that correct? You know, the Bible has much to say about these questions and where we have originated. And I don't think in society today we spend as much time as did our parents and our grandfathers and grandmothers contemplating these questions. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at what the Bible says about our origins. We're going to see where we originated from and how the theory of evolution violates many laws of science and how evolution, although it's unprovable, affects us today. Now you may say, oh, evolution is a theory that's, you know, taught in some universities. You get a little smattering of it in high school, and you know it really doesn't affect us. It doesn't affect society as a whole. And I'm here to tell you that it does, and many of us don't realize that it does. Now, if you're an adamant note-taker, I'm going to go ahead and give you some points. And the first one is that evolution is supported by the media because it is socially popular. It allows people, as I like to phrase it, to do their own thing. It allows people to do their own thing. Evolution allows people to live as they please. You know, science, and this may sound strange to you, but science has always been used by society to reinforce what is culturally popular at the time. What is culturally popular at the time. I'd like to have you think about something. Adolf Hitler was a firm believer in evolution. He was a firm believer in the science of eugenics. And through eugenics, he proved to his own satisfaction that there were races that were inferior to others. And because races were inferior to others, he could use or help along the evolutionary process and eliminate these inferior races, and then the other races would achieve the ascendancy. Obviously, I hope you don't have to have me go into all the gory details. But eugenics was one of the things that he used to prove this. Now, eugenics was very popular in the early 1900s. And this science, as it was called back then, allowed society to suppress those who were not as cultural or of the proper social standing and of the right racial background. I want you to think about something. How was it that women, for so long, were denied the vote? Do you think that people were just, you think that the men in society, and I'm a man, so I'm speaking as a man, do you think that men were just brutes and imposed their will on women and women didn't vote because we just were so dominant? No. Do you know that there was scientific evidence that showed that women were not as intelligent as men? Science falsely so-called, as the Bible says. I'd like to read you a quote out of the Encyclopedia Britannica. I've got a lot of quotes that I'm going to be reading to you because there's a lot of material to back up the things I'm going to be telling you. This is out of the Encyclopedia Britannica. The title is The American Eugenics Society. This is the title of the article, Eugenics. The American Eugenics Society, founded in 1926, supported the proposition that the wealth and social position of the upper classes was justified by a superior genetic endowment. U.S. eugenists also supported restrictions on immigration from nations with inferior, quote-unquote, stock, such as Italy, Greece, and the countries of Eastern Europe, and argued for the sterilization of insane, retarded, and epileptic citizens in the United States. This was all backed up by scientific data. As a result of their efforts, sterilization laws were passed in more than half of the United States, and isolated instances of involuntary sterilization continued into the 1970s. The assumptions of eugenists came under sharp criticism beginning in the 1930s and were discredited after the Nazis used eugenics to support the extermination of Jews, blacks, and homosexuals. I'd like to bring up the concept of craniometry. This is one of the books that I had on display down here. This book, ironically, is written by an evolutionist, and it's a historical rendering of the subject of eugenics. And you know, this morning, if you were here this morning, we were talking about how scientists are very biased and how they find what they want to find. Well, I'd like to read you out of The Mismeasure of Man. This is written by Stephen Jay Gould. He is a very adamant evolutionist, has written many journal articles and many books, and was a professor for many years at various universities and institutions. And he's a staunch evolutionist. And I'd like to read you what it says in the introduction of this book on page 21 and 22. And I want you to listen to it and listen to what he says. Science, since people must do it, is a socially embedded activity. Think about what that means. Science is a socially embedded activity. And let your mind go back to the early 1900s, to when women in certain races could not vote. It progresses by hunch, vision, and intuition. Much of it changes through time. Much of its change through time does not record a closer approach to absolute truth, but the alteration of cultural contexts that influence it so strongly. Facts are not pure and unsullied bits of information. Culture also influences what we see and how we see it. Theories, moreover, are not inexorable inductions from facts. The most creative theories are often imaginative visions imposed upon facts. The source of imagination is also strongly cultural. What he's saying, if you're an Aggie and I'll interpret it for you, what he's saying is that culture affects the science and the research it does. There's scientific evidence to show that homosexuality is just an alternate lifestyle. Chapter 3, Measuring Heads. Now, what these people did, this eugenics, what they did is they would take a skull and they would turn the skull upside down and they would fill it full of beans or sometimes lead shot. And then they would take the lead shot and they would put it in a glass and they would pour out the skull full of lead shot or beans, and they would measure how many millimeters of space that this skull took. And the more space it took, the more brains you had. And the more brains you had, the more genetically endowed you were. Very simple concept. Very simple concept. You know, you've often heard of the term, you know, how's your manager? Well, he's an old bean counter. You know where that term came from? It came from eugenics. You know, they would count the beans. How smart is this guy? Well, he sits around and he counts beans. And by how many beans he's counted, he makes an evaluation of what you're like. That's where the term came from. Next time someone says, this guy's a real bean counter, it just means that he counted the beans that were in the crania. That's where it came from. Now, let me read to you what it says in chapter 3, Measuring Heads, page 80 and 82. Prior prejudice, not copious numeric documentation, dictates conclusions. I didn't write that. He did. We can scarcely doubt that beans, that was the name of the researcher that measured the amount of beans in these crania, and Gould is writing about bean, doubt that beans, early researcher in craniometry, statements about blacks reflected a prior belief that he set out to objectify, not an induction from data about fronts and backs of brains. In other words, Bean was raised in a culture where blacks were inferior. And since blacks were inferior, this preconceived notion colored the research that he did. It colored the amount of beans he counted. And I'm going to show you that in a minute. And the special pleadings that yielded black inferiority from equality of brain size is ludicrous outside a shared context of a prior belief in the inferiority of blacks. He got all these black skulls and Eastern European skulls and skulls of Native Americans and of other races, and he measured them, and skulls of men and skulls of women, and guess which one came out on top as having the most beans? The white male. You guessed it. Now, another quote, numbers and graphs do not gain authority from increasing precision of measurement, sample size, or complexity in manipulation. Basic experimental designs may be flawed and not subject to the correction by extended repetition. Prior commitment to one among many potential conclusions often guarantees a serious flaw in design. So what Gould was saying is that Bean's experiments were flawed because he had a prior conclusion. What was the prior conclusion? That people, some people, were not as genetically endowed because they had smaller brains than other people. Craniometry was not just a plaything of academians, a subject confined to technical journals. So you say the same thing about evolution today. Conclusions flooded the popular press. In the 1920s, this theory was very popular, and you could read about it in many magazines, in many articles, and it was taught in the schools. Conclusions flooded the popular press. Often entrenched, they often embarked on a life of their own, endlessly copied from secondary source to secondary source, refractory to disproof because on one examined the fragility of primary documentation. In this case, Moll, who was an opponent of Bean, nipped the dogma in the bud. In other words, he showed that Bean's conclusions were incorrect. But not before a leading journal had recommended that blacks be barred from voting as a consequence of their innate stupidity. You know why they're considered stupid? There wasn't as many beans in their skulls to be counted. But Franklin P. Moll, Bean's mentor at Johns Hopkins, you know, we're not dealing with some fly-by-night university. This was the studies done at Johns Hopkins. Mentor at Johns Hopkins became suspicious. So Moll became suspicious of Bean's methods. Bean's data was too good. He repeated Bean's work, but with one important difference in procedure. You know what this second researcher did that made all the difference? Think in your mind what he did. He repeated Bean's work, but with an important difference in procedure. He made sure that he did not know which brains were from blacks and which brains were from whites until after he had measured them. From a sample of 106 brains using Bean's methods of measurements, he found no difference between whites and blacks in the relative size of their brains. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Page 85, same book. I, Gould, spent a month reading all of Broca's major work. He was another researcher. Paul Broca was professor of clinical surgery in the Faculty of Medicine at Johns Hopkins. He founded the Anthropological Society of Paris in 1859, one of the proponents later on of the Darwin's theory of evolution. And I, Gould, spent a month reading all of Broca's major work, concentrating on his statistical procedure. I found a definite pattern in his methods. He traversed the gap between fact and conclusion by what may be the usual route, predominantly in reverse. Conclusions came first, and Broca's conclusions were the shared assumptions of most, who do you think agreed with his conclusions? Most successful white males during his times, themselves on top by the good fortune of nature, and women, blacks, and poor people below. There was scientific evidence, lady. You should be doing this to your husband about now. There was scientific evidence to show that you were not as smart as men, and that blacks weren't as smart as whites, and that the people from Eastern Europe who were trying to immigrate to the United States weren't as smart as the regular people that lived here, and therefore immigration quotas were put on them, and women were denied the vote. It was all done scientifically. His facts were reliable, but they were gathered selectively and then manipulated unconsciously in the service of prior conclusions. By this route, the conclusions achieved not only the blessings of science, but the prestige of numbers. I mean, after all, I'm only counting beans. You can't make any kind of subjective or objective. I mean, you just count beans. That's all you do. What's wrong with that? Broca and his school used facts as illustrations, not as constraining documents. They began with conclusions, peered through their facts, and came back in circle to the same conclusions. If you believe that there is no God, you can look at all the data, and you can come up with a conclusion that there is no God. It's not a hard concept to follow. They did it in the 1920s with eugenics. Now, you think, okay, so what? Evolution does not affect me. It's not in the popular press. I'm not a scientist poring over scientific journal articles. Any of you familiar with these two magazines? Newsweek, or actually Time, May 8th, 2000, a few months ago, and August 14th, 2000, Newsweek. I'd like to read you a couple of articles. These are the articles that you're reading at home, you know, as you're waiting for your wife to cook supper, or have you proved to your husband that you're smarter than him for your husband to cook supper? Okay. I like to cook, but I'm already married. Okay. If you're, while you're waiting for supper to be cooked, you're reading this magazine, or you're in the doctor's office, or in the dentist's office, or you're at school waiting to see your counselor, you pick up magazines like this and you read them. I'd like to read you out of an article in Time, May the 8th, it's on page 58. And it's entitled, What Mother Nature Teaches Us About Motherhood. There's a mother in a tree. Because you see, after all, we're only animals. I'd like to read you what it says in this article here. What Mother Nature Teaches Us About Motherhood, this is May 8, 2000, volume 155, number 19, under Science and Society. Science, very objective, is it not? All you do is count beans. Very objective. With squalling infants in tow, she works back-breaking shifts as long as 17 hours a day to feed her growing family. Then she drags herself home, where she is greeted by her equally demanding older children, who expect her to referee their squabbles as they roughhouse and play. When the kids finally fall asleep, she has only a few hours to eat, clean up, and grab some shut-eye before the sun rises. She must do it all over again. Typical working mother? No. A wild baboon living in the plains of Kenya. For scientists studying the... You see where this is going, don't you? For scientists studying the business of parenting, parting the curtain on the animal world helps explain not only how mothering strategies work, but also how they sometimes break down. Confused teens aren't the only mothers who abandon their babies. I know some, not personally, but I know of teen mothers who put their babies in the dumpster, who have them in the bathroom and put them in the commodes. After all, we're only animals, right? Doesn't affect us, right? We don't read those articles, journal articles, right? Confused teens aren't the only mothers who abandon their babies. Other mammals do it too. Parents may recoil when Susan Smith drowns her sons in a South Carolina pond, but scientists routinely observe infanticidal animals, apparently driven by similarly dark demons, committing similarly dark acts. Let me read you a little bit more of what it says. If an impulse to commit infanticide is indeed part of our genetic legacy, I mean, you know, we're animals, and animals abandon and kill their young, and if we're only animals and we have the same genetic background, why should it seem odd to you that we would do that? We've really come a long way, brethren, haven't we? If an impulse to commit infanticide is indeed part of our genetic legacy, can it be forgiven? Or does such a crime remain a crime no matter how strong the primary drives behind it? Anthropologists take a long view, at least when the crime is abandonment and not murder. I think we have to re-examine the harsh penalties we place on young, uneducated women who abandon infants, says anthropologist Helen Fisher of Rutgers University. Not a fly-by-night university, very prestigious. They were dancing to primitive natural rhythms and they got out of sync. I mean, after all, we're only animals, right? Just what distinguishes the higher species of primates from the very highest ones is not always clearly understood. But one of the most important differences seems to be the delight humans take in challenging their primitive urges and even flat-out denying them. In other words, it's only natural that we think about killing our young because that's something that we have inherited through evolution and genetics from our forefathers who were simply animals. Hardy, another anthropologist, writes that when her children were babies, she often cooed to them in nonsensical endearments that were oddly evocative of food. Sweet potato, muffin, cutie pie, she would call them. I could eat you up. She'd gush. Why she chose these words to babble, she couldn't say. But after a period of what she calls Darwinian self-analysis, she realized that she might actually be hearing the echoes of some genetic programming buried deep within the carnivorous parts of her brain. It's really scary when you analyze it. It really is. That's out of Time article in May called What Mother Nature Teaches Us About Motherhood. You know what Mother Nature teaches us about motherhood? If you're an evolutionist, it teaches you that it's okay to abandon your children. Because after all, that's what the animals do and the monkeys in Kenya do. And we are no better than the animals. You think it doesn't affect you? I'm here to tell you that it does. It does. And if it doesn't affect you, it affects the person you work with and the person you discuss football with and the person you ride the metro with. And it affects how they look at you. This is out of Time magazine. This is on page 44. Excuse me, this is out of Newsweek, page 44. This is called Sex, get everybody's attention, Sex and the Single Fly. Very popular magazine, Newsweek. Probably read it, didn't even know it. I'd like to read you what it says on page 44. Some comments about it. How routinely, once they started looking, biologists found promiscuous females in some 70% of the species they studied. You know where I'm going with this, don't you? I mean, after all of the females of the species are promiscuous, what does that mean for us, ladies? Doesn't affect us, does it? A clutch of grasshopper eggs can have several fathers. 35% of baby indigo buntings are sired by a male other than the guy mom came home in. Some 76% of Australian fairy wrens have different fathers. Female chimps copulate a total of 500 to 1,000 times for each pregnancy. A 1997 study using DNA to run paternity tests found that 54% of baby chimps were fathered by males other than mom's supposed partner. And I'm not going to read all of this because I just had lunch. Wh- Which brings us to the central question. What do females get out of promiscuity? No, besides that. One benefit of polyandry, in other words, one female, many males, is the increased resources and protection for the female and her brood. In other words, if you're a female of the species and you play around, you're going to have the attention of more than one male. And therefore, you're going to be better off with your resources and your food because all these males are going to feed you. You got the chimpanzees there, and you got what I term the single babes, right there in the middle. And this is teaching us, teaching your children, your daughters, and the sons that read this, that after all, we're just animals. All of this is straight out of evolutionary dogma and concept. All of it. The Bible, fortunately, is not based on man's theories. Man's theories can change depending on the mode and the mood of society at that particular time in history. This is one of the biggest problems with evolution. It can be used to support an immoral society. Contrast this type of philosophy with the teachings from an unchangeable source, a source that is not dependent on man. I want you to read you another article out of another magazine. This is out of this magazine that was published within a month of the other two. It's out of the July-August 2000 Good News. I want to read you an article out of here, or read you some quotes out of here. It's in an article that's entitled, it's on page 26. Let me just read right out of the article. I want you to contrast this philosophy with the other philosophy. It says, the title of it, written by Mr. Dave Trabig, "Have you performed your vows today?" Contrast this article with the articles I just read you. One is based on God's way, the other is based on man's way. It says, when we make a covenant with God, He expects us to honor that covenant, even on the days when we wake up feeling no longer in love. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for He has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. We, it says here, need to emphasize the personal responsibility each of us has to make in fulfilling our vows. Vows made to us are binding. Vows made to you are binding upon me, O God, it says in Psalms. It says, so I will sing praises to your name forever, and I will daily perform my vows. If you are married, consider these important questions. Marriage is not a physical relationship that exists on a human plane. It is a God-plane relationship. It was instituted by God to help us prepare for His eternal, for an eternal relationship with Him and His Son, Jesus. Contrast those quotes to the quotes that I just read you. These quotes are timeless. They've been in there for thousands of years. They're not going to change when new scientific evidence is discovered. And the reason is because their source is God. I'd like you to go to your Bibles to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. And we're going to look at some of the things as it concerns the Bible and the evolutionary philosophy. I don't even like to call it a theory. It is a philosophy. Genesis chapter 1. And we've covered some of this morning, but for the sake of those of you that weren't here, I'm going to review this a little bit. It says, in the beginning, of verse 1 of Genesis 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now I want you to consider something from a scientific point of view. The Genesis account is a recreation account. It says that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The word was in Genesis chapter 2, or chapter 1, verse 2, is the word haya. It means became, as it's translated in other places, or it can be translated became. Depends on the context. And so the word to be translated, the earth became without form and void, or confused and chaotic. The earth was created perfectly. Something destroyed the earth, and then the earth was recreated. Does this agree, just this one little thing here, does this agree with the laws of science? Think about it. Something was created perfect, then it was destroyed, became chaotic and confused, and then God recreated it. You know, if you look in the solar system, there's ample evidence of astral catastrophes. You maybe never have considered it. Consider the craters on the moon. The moon is pockmarked with craters. In history, there was giant mountains that hit the earth of flying debris and created the craters that are on there. They're not being created now. They were created in the past. So something was ramming into the moon to create all the craters that are there. The rings of Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Jupiter. You know, had the space probes fly by there and take all these pictures, send them back. You know what ring systems are made from? They're made from pulverized moons and rock. Where did the pulverized rock and moon come from? You know, we tend to think of the solar system as being very smoothly operating, like a precision watch. If you had a watch face and a crystal and it was all scratched up and beat up and carved out, you'd think that that arm had been somewhere where it shouldn't have been because the watch was with it. Look at the solar system. Look at the rings around Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. Former moons that were destroyed, shattered, compacted, pulverized, and because of Bode's law, are now circling because of the gravitational forces that are around the planet in a systemic motion. Think about Miranda. You know, you have Miranda, which is one of Uranus's smaller moons. You've seen pictures of it that were taken during the flyby of Voyager 2 in 1986. The planet was broken in two and then put back together. What broke up this world and sheared it in two and then gravity pulled it back together? What caused that? Look at the asteroid belt. You know, you've got Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. After so many millions of miles, there should be another planet because there's a little gravitational track there. So at 33 million miles, you have Mercury. At another 33 million miles, which is 66 million miles, you have Venus. At another 33 million miles, which is about 93 million miles, you have Earth. And another 33 million miles, at 120 million miles, you have Mars. And another 33 million miles, you have a blank spot full of rocks and debris. And then another 33 million miles, you have Jupiter. What was in the space between Mars and Jupiter? You have a planet that apparently was pulverized. You have the orbit of Pluto, goes out beyond the solar system, then comes back in to some of the planets, then goes back out. What perturbed, or what moved that planet out of its orbit and perturbed it so that it does this? You know, the solar system is not a finely functioning precision piece of art right now. It was once, but it's not anymore. The whole solar system has scars of past planetary catastrophes. The Bible tells me when I read it that Satan was created, and when the earth was created, he shouted for joy. He shouted for joy because the earth was created. And it says that he was at one time summed up wisdom and beauty until what? Iniquity was found in him. And when iniquity was found in him, he tried to rise to heaven and to say, I am as good as the Most High. Isn't it interesting, brethren, that Jesus Christ and God the Father are coming down to earth to tabernacle with men, and that Satan is going to get his wish and get to go to heaven, where the blackness, as it talks about in the book of Jude, awaits him? But my point is this. The solar system, the earth, were once a beautiful creation. They have been wrecked. And the Bible talks about war in heaven. Haven't you read that? In Revelation 12, and there was war in heaven, and I saw Satan and his angels, and they went to war against the angels of God. And as I mentioned this morning, if you've ever been in a fight with your brother or your sister, things get messed up. The solar system was destroyed because of the battle that took place between God's angels and Satan and his demons. That agrees perfectly, brethren, with the biblical record. Agrees perfectly. The sin of the angels wrecked the solar system and the earth. And then the earth became a dump and had to be remade. And this is a recreation account that we read of in Genesis chapter 1. Another point is that the creation account agrees with the geological evidence and the other laws of science. I'll give you an example. There were two time periods of earth-wide flooding in the geologic record. Notice Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God, in verse 9, gathers the waters into one place, and he gathers the dry land into one place, which implies that there was no dry land before he created the dry land. He rose up the mountains that formed the continents, and the earth was divided into dry and into water. This agrees exactly with the geologic record. Agrees exactly with it. Genesis chapter 6. We covered this extensively this morning in verse 17. "And behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from heaven, from under heaven, all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die." You know what scientists tell you about the Pleistocene era? That during the Pleistocene era, which equates to the Ice Ages, which equates to the time of the flood, that there was a great dying of mammals that lived on land. Why aren't you told that at school? That's not correct politically. That smacks too much of floods, catastrophes, and things that have the breath of life on dry land dying. Thousands of species died out during the Ice Ages. And during the Ice Ages, there was vast sheets of water that covered the earth. But instead of happening in a short time, they happened over hundreds of thousands of millions of years, supposedly. The two time periods of the global flooding correspond to the two great geological time periods. The first flooding, which was the flooding that occurred before Adam was created in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, corresponds to the Mesozoic, Paleozoic, and Precambrian eras, which included the Devonian period, part of the Paleozoic. You know what the Devonian period is called? Guess what? The Age of Fishes. You know why it's called the Age of Fishes? Because there was a lot of fish there, because there was a lot of water. The Bible says that before the time of Adam, there was water covering all of the earth. Would you expect a lot of fishes? Yes, you would. Yes, you would. The second included portions of the Cenozoic period, which included the Pleistocene epoch. The Pleistocene epoch corresponds to the Ice Ages. The Ice Ages correspond to the flooding and the change of the climate after the flood. There is a time period between Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. The earth had a prehistory before the recreation account in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. Perfectly agreeable with a geologic record. You don't need to have faith, young people, that God's word is correct in these things. You can prove it geologically. I'd like to read over the Genesis 1 account with you. I'd like to show you some things that God writes that are perfectly agreeable with science, yet if you look at it from an evolutionary point of view, violates laws of science. Notice, first of all, before you get to Genesis, let's go to Colossians. Colossians, chapter 1. This is talking about Jesus Christ. And notice Colossians 1, verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God. There is a God that is invisible. Hold your place here in Colossians. We're going to come back to it in a minute. Go back to Genesis chapter 1. And let's look at what it says in Genesis chapter 1. And let's skim the chapter and let's come up with some scientific concepts here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth had become chaotic and confused, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, and God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And He creates day and night. And verse 6, and He divides the waters in the hydrosphere from the waters in the atmosphere. And verse 8, He creates the second day. Then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. So in the first couple of verses, God reorganizes the atmosphere. And there was a chaotic state where the aqueous substances of the earth were mixed together, and He divides this, and He puts the water that filled up the oceans in the ocean basins, and He created the hydrosphere that exists in the atmosphere. And verse 11, then God said, "Let the earth bring forth grasses, the herbs that yield seed, and the fruit trees that yield fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herbs that yield seed according to its kind. The grasses made other grasses according to their kind. According to their kind, they made grasses. When you mate a dog and a dog, you get a dog. When you procreate grasses, you get grasses. You get the same thing. You ever read about Mendel and his works on genetics? Verse 13, the third day was made. Verse 14, and God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let there be for signs and seasons, for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. Then God made to appear, as it should read, because you see, He'd already created the earth and the galaxies and the stars and the moon and the sun before Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. He'd already created it because the angels shouted for joy when they saw it come into existence. So here it's saying, and God made or caused to appear two great lights. He cleared the atmosphere and the sun shone through. The greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He also, it doesn't say He made, that's in italics. He, the stars also. He caused the stars to appear also. When you can see the moon, you can see the stars. He didn't make the stars on the fourth day. They were already made. He just caused them to appear. Perfectly agreeable with science. And verse 19, the evening and the morning were the fourth day. Then God said, "Let the waters abound with the abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament in the heavens." So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, which was on the water, which with which the waters abounded according to their kind. The animals procreated, reproduced, and made other animals that looked just like them. And every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the sea, and let the birds multiply on the earth." And then we have the fifth day. In verse 24, then God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth." And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's according to its kind. It's according to its kind. You can perform all kinds of genetic experiments, and you know what you find? That things are going to make the same thing that existed before them. Isn't that amazing? There's never been an experiment made where they've taken something and made something different out of it. We're talking about biological systems here. Nothing. They've never done it. They've tried for hundreds of years to do it, and they can't do it. And the Bible here says that things are going to make things according to their kind. Johnny, what a 3-year-old, what happens when you have a doggy and a doggy and they get together? What do you get? You get puppies. It's so simple, a child can see it. I have articles here, journal articles, that talk about footprints that were placed in strata 4.5 million years old, and they look identical to the footprints that you and I would make. And it says in the articles that a four-year-old would identify them as human. But they're not identified as humans. You know why? Because humans didn't exist back 4.5 million years ago, according to the evolutionary theory and their time scale. I wager you that there were men walking around at that time who were fully man. And I'm not talking about 4.5 million years ago because they have misinterpreted the data and the strata. But at the time they thought these 4.5 million-year-old proto-humans were walking, there were men who made footprints that looked just like the footprints you and I make. And you know what the scientists say? They say, we know they're not human because the time element is not right. They can't be. It's impossible. Well, yeah, it's impossible if you believe in the theory of evolution. It is. If you believe that God created everything and that man was created and there's variations of man, then it's not impossible. It makes perfect sense. Verse 25, and God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, and cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image. Who are you patterned after, brethren? I don't know about you. And I'm being rhetorical here. I hope you understand that. But I have been made after the God kind. That perfectly agrees with science. Kind brings forth its own. Animals bring forth animals. If I'm made after the God kind, I'm going to be of that lineage. Don't make me be plain. I have been, and so have you, been fashioned after the God kind. Evolution tries to rob you of that. You have not been, and neither have I, all the evidence supposed to. Notwithstanding, you have not been fashioned and formed by a lucky conglomeration of chance mutational chromosomal aberrations. You are here because God formed your father out of red dirt. And he breathed into him the breath of life, and man became a living soul, or nephesh, or person. Verse 26. Then God said, let us, because there was two God beings, the Father and the Son, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God said, be fruitful, and they brought forth more kind like they were. It is not incorrect scientifically to say that God is making more of himself. When God created the cattle were instructed to bring forth more cattle. And man has been made and fashioned after the God kind. And don't let anybody tell you different. Go back to Colossians and keep your place in Genesis. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, first resurrected. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him. We have evolution that raises its ugly head, and evolution supposedly follows chemical and biological laws. Who instituted those laws? Where did those laws come from? Where did the chemical laws and the processes of light and photosynthesis, where did all those laws come from? Somebody made them. It says here, verse 16, he created all things, whether you see them or whether you don't. Infrared radiation going all up and down this room right now. Don't see it, but it's there. Because I can't see it, does that mean it doesn't exist? There's a spirit world, brethren. If you don't see it, I don't either. We kind of have a foretaste of it. We sense it in certain ways. Does that mean it doesn't exist? God created the things you see, whether they're visible or whether they're invisible. All things, in verse 16, were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist. Notice John chapter 1. John chapter 1. Verse 1. I want you to think about this scientifically. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So we have a God that's with the Word, and the Word is God, so we have two gods together. And all things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. In Him was life, and life was the light of men. God is life. Where does living things come from? Life. That's one of the laws of science called biogenesis. Things have to be alive to create other living things. If you have dead things, they won't create living things. Refer you to the works of Louis Pasteur. Every time you go to the refrigerator and you get that piece of cake and you pour yourself a glass of milk that's pasteurized from Louis Pasteur, remember that things that are living have to come from living things, because if you pasteurize and kill them, no bacteria will grow in it. That's a law of science. I did not come from rocks. Oh, we didn't come from rocks, as one person told me once. We came from lower life forms. I said, well, bear with me. Where did the mammals come from? Oh, the mammals. They came from the dinosaurs and the reptiles. Okay? Where did the dinosaurs and the reptiles come from? Well, they came from the birds. Okay? Where did the birds come from? Well, the birds evolved from the fishes. Okay? Where did the fishes come from? Well, they came from these organisms that were in the sea. Okay? Where did these organisms from the sea come from? Well, they came from the single-celled organisms that were in the water. Uh-huh. Where did they come from? Well, they came from this biotic soup that was in past millennia floating around with amino acids and all kinds of things, and lightning struck it and life began. Okay, where did the amino acids come from? Well, the water was washing over the rocks. I haven't come from rocks. You know, if you believe in evolution, you literally believe that you have descended from rocks. If you take it back to its logical conclusion, I didn't come from rocks, brethren, and neither did you. I came from something that gave me life, which agrees with all the scientific laws that we know, which means that living things produce living things, which is one of the laws of biogenesis, which is fully founded on all the works of Louis Pasteur. Everybody remember Louis Pasteur's experiments with the flask, and he bent it and he heated it and all, you know, I'm not going to go through all that, but he basically said if you kill a broth and make it dead, that no dead thing, nothing's going to come out of it, because people back in the 1500s believed in spontaneous generation. You left a piece of meat out and it would grow flies. They would just produce out of the meat. They would generate themselves spontaneously. And Louis Pasteur tried to show people that no, they come from the eggs the fly lays on there, and then those egg flies pupate and they grow into flies. And he did this, and he showed experimentally that living things can only come from living things. It sort of reminds me of the mad professor, you know, dressed in the white smock. You know, his hair's all frizzy, he's got these big glasses on, he's got all kinds of pins, he's got a clipboard, and he's got all these equations written on the blackboard. And he says, I'm going to create life to show that life can come from non-intelligible forces. If he ever did it, it would deny his conclusion because he's intelligent. You see where that's leading? If a human can ever create life, it just means it takes intelligence to do it. And no one has ever been able to create life, because there is only one life giver. He's also called the lawgiver. He created the laws of thermodynamics. He created the laws of chemistry. He created the laws of radiation. He created the laws of gravity. He created all these laws that are in motion to make evolution supposedly, quote unquote, work. My creator is talked about, and so is yours here in the book of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. It's no different today. Verse 11. Verse 10. He was in the world, and the world was made through Him, and the world did not know Him. Let that sink in. You have the creator of all of the universe, who created all the laws that we look at and live with. He created everything. He was in the world, and the world did not know him. You think he's going to know you, a child of his? I don't think so. You're in good company. Don't feel bad when the world doesn't agree with you. It's not supposed to. They didn't agree with Christ. You had Pilate, and you had Christ, and they were 3 feet away. And Christ is expounding about truth, and Pilate says, ha, what's truth? And he's sitting 3 feet away in the flesh. If I could just explain to people these things, they would see it. No, they will not, because they're blind. And you are not. I really think in the church, brethren, that we don't realize how unique we are. We sell ourselves short. We sell ourselves short. Go back to Genesis. Genesis chapter 1, verse 25. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to the cattle kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to the creeping on the earth kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image. We are created after the God kind, brethren. We are not here because of evolution. We are here because God fashioned us and created us. Where are we from? We're from God, the light of men, the light that the world did not recognize. That's where we're from. And if you just went through the Holy Day festival season and you tabernacled, we're temporary. My tabernacle is up here, and it's decaying and running down because I am subject to the second law of thermodynamics. And whether I live 969 years like Methuselah or whether I luckily live to be 75 and die, the result is the same. I'm going to die. I am going to die. There is no, if evolution is true, we are of most men, of all men, most sorry. Because that's all there is. That's all there is. Evolution is not scientific. It violates many laws of science. I want you to go to 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy. First Timothy chapter 6. Maybe a little different in the version you're using. I'm using the New King James Version. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 20. O Timothy, you think that evolution is a problem now? You think that philosophy is a problem now? You think that you're the only one, woe is me, that's lived in a society that's decadent and uses science to support immorality? People are the same in all times, brethren. They're the same thought processes. The procedures may be a little different, but the end result is the same. O Timothy, guard what was committed to your trust. We have been given a trust, whether you're 17, 18, 19 years old, and you're trying to decide whether this is your religion or your parents, or whether you're 50 or 60 years old, and I've already made that commitment. We all have a job. Guard what was committed to your trust, avoiding the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. Some margins render it science. By professing it, some have strayed concerning the faith. He got so smart, he worked himself out of the church. Guard what was committed to your trust. We have been given a trust. We have to guard it. And you can either follow the ways of this world and society and its teachings, or you can base your foundation on what God's Word says. And I cannot make that decision for you. You can't make it for me. We have to make it for ourselves. We have to make it for ourselves. You know, in the Bible, in Romans 8, 1, it says that knowledge puffs up. Don't turn there. But it says knowledge puffs up. That word is science. Science can make people so intelligent that after a while, you believe in the flood. You believe in Genesis. You believe what it, you know, you believe what it says there. Come on! It takes less faith to believe in a God than it does to believe in man's theories. You can believe in them if you want, but it takes less faith to believe in a God. Because God's laws uphold the laws of genetics. It says that kind reproduces after its own kind. Gregor Mendel, Austrian monk, discovered the laws of genetics. Creatures reproduce after their kind. That's one of the laws of science. You know, there's a law of mutations. Mutations are 99.999, stretch it out about another 7 or 8 digits, 99.999% bad. How would you like to get on an airplane that had a 99.9999% chance of having something go wrong with it? Not me. Not me. I wouldn't do that. The laws of hybridization. You know what happens when you mate a mule? Excuse me, when you mate a donkey and a horse, you get a mule. And a mule is sterile. It can't. You don't get more mules by breeding mules together. Every mule is produced by the union of a burro and a horse. A stallion and a mare burro. They're all produced that way. And they're all sterile. You know why? We're getting close to the limits of the kind. And God has put an invisible barrier there, not invisible, but a scientific barrier there, that doesn't let the chromosomes change into something that it's not supposed to, because God said kind reproduces after its own kind, and there's nothing we can do to change that. Everybody remember Dolly, the sheep they cloned? You know, we say, oh, Dolly, that was a great thing. You know, we cloned a sheep. You know that your helpmeet was cloned from your rib. God was cloning thousands of years before man did it. We think, oh, God, man is not as smart as God. Because, see, man can clone things. God cloned us a perfect helper. Only difference is got an X and an X, and we have an X and a Y. God was cloning long before it was thought of. But you know what happened when man cloned Dolly? Then they cloned Dolly's clone. And they cloned her one more time, and you know what happened? Became sterile. Can't keep cloning and cloning and cloning and cloning. The DNA material starts to break down. You've got that invisible barrier there that God's not going to let be violated. Man cannot create life. If he's lucky, he may be able to rearrange it, but it's not going to be in any kind of good state, because you can't improve on what God has done. And that's one of the laws of science. You got the laws of genetics, you got the laws of mutations, you got the laws of hybridization, you got the laws of biogenesis. We already discussed that. You got the second law of thermodynamics. What's it say? Flashlight's going to go dead, basically. That's what it says. You got the heat in a system, and it's going to become less usable for work. Our hot things are getting cold. Our energy is running out. Our things are wearing down. Every chemical reaction that takes place is underneath the umbrella of the second law of thermodynamics. Let's go to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. You know, the Bible talks about the second law of thermodynamics, just like it talks about these other laws we talked about. Notice Romans chapter 8, verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us, for the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealings of the sons of God. You know what the universe is waiting for? It's waiting for you. We're going to make Star Wars look like tiddlywinks. The universe is waiting for you and for me. You know what's waiting for you if you believe in evolution? Death. Verse 19, for the earnest expectation of the creation, of the creature, the creation of the universe, eagerly waits for the revealings of the sons of God. For the universe was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. What is futility? Things are vain or running down. The whole universe is imprinted with a second law of thermodynamics. There's only one, there's only two beings, one being, God being, but two in him. There's only two beings that are above this law, and that is God, because he has life inherent in himself. And since he's above it, it has no hold on him. And your father is the one that created those laws. And if you're born like him, you're going to be above those laws. What do you think is going to happen to the universe that's running down when you're born in it? Verse 21. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. We are going to take the decaying universe and we are going to somewhere or other remove from it the curse of decay. I don't know how that's going to work, but I just read my Bible. Think about what that means to you personally. Oh, my back hurts. My knees hurt. My bunions hurt. I have a test at school. My boss is really giving me a hard time. The car won't start. My parents are being real heavy-handed with me. Woe is me. And I'm telling you, brethren, there is nothing on this earth to compare with what is awaiting for you and for me. You know why God let some of his saints be killed and tortured and did not deliver them? You know why? You know why some of them were crucified? You know why some of them were beheaded? You know why some of them were boiled in oil? You know why some of them were flayed and sawn in two? You know why? Because all the things they went through are nothing in comparison to what they're going to get. Nothing. Verse 21, read it again. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. The universe is waiting for us. It's waiting for us. And that's why I can turn to the book of Romans, to the book of Psalms. Go to the book of Psalms. And I can say in Psalms 53 what it says. And why I can say it, and I don't have to apologize for it. And why you can believe it. Verse 1 of Psalm 53. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. It's foolish when you consider all the laws that exist. All the chemical reactions that take place. The laws of gravity. The creation. The workings of your hand. How all of those things operate and function and the design in the universe, how God can say, if you don't believe in me, you're a fool. And didn't say that you had to have the Holy Spirit. This is not talking about converted people, brethren. This is just talking about people that are blind in the world, because it should be so obvious to anybody, even if you're not religious, that something greater than ourselves made us. When I see that red Mercedes driving down the highway, the engineer who designed that, male or female, was very intelligent. Because design implies the intelligence of the creator. And if you don't believe that there's a God, which in essence means you don't believe in a creator, then you're a fool. And like I say, it's not talking here about people that have the Holy Spirit, as I showed in the book of Romans. You don't have to have the Holy Spirit to understand that there's a God. I know a lot of people that are not religious that believe in a God. Go back to Genesis. You know what the problem with Adam and Eve was? Go back to Genesis chapter 2. And let's look at this chapter real quickly. The heavens and the earth and all the hosts of them were created and finished. And God rests on the Sabbath day. And that in verse 3, and God blessed the Sabbath day and sanctified it because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. There are a lot of invisible laws that God has created. It is not better to give than to receive if you want to look at it from a purely carnal point of view. But it is an invisible law that it is better to give than to receive. You can't prove physically that the Sabbath is any better or any worse than any other day. But you can prove it spiritually. Verse 8, the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put a man whom he had formed. And God causes the tree to grow. And in chapter 3, Adam and Eve performed the first scientific experiment. I perform all kinds of experiments, usually a couple every week. And I can tell you usually how they're going to come out, because I have to teach it to my class. But Adam and Eve performed the first scientific experiment. What did they do? Well, let's keep reading. Verse 2, "We may eat of all the fruit of the tree of garden," said the woman. "But of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God said, don't eat, because in the day you eat, you're going to start to die." Then the serpent said, "Oh, you're not going to die? Come on. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So you know what the woman did? What the woman did is she used her five senses. She saw the fruit, whatever it was, and this fruit is just swinging in the boughs of the tree. Boy, it looks good. Got that nice glow on it. It looks so beautiful, and those leaves, whatever color they were, very appealing to the eyes. And then what did she do? She got the fruit, and maybe she plucked it, and you know, it wasn't a prickly pear because she didn't drop it. It felt good. It had a nice feel to it. Oh, it's really nice. Looks good. It feels good. And then what you do? Oh, it's got a nice aroma. Smells good. Smells good. And, you know, it's got a nice sound to it. I could hear it rustling in the leaves and tree as the wind was hitting it. It's got a nice sound to it. And she took the tree, she took the fruit and she bit it. No, she didn't do that. She ate it. It was so good, she gave some to her husband. Doop, 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 doop. And he ate of the tree too. And you know, everything looks great. It looks good, it tastes good, it feels good, it's got a nice sound to it. There was only one problem with her experiment. And it's the same problem that we're going to have if we're not careful when we evaluate data. What is that? She did all these things. She saw it, she touched it, she tasted it, she felt it, she listened to it, and the result was death. Why? This is the same technique that is used by science today to prove there is no need for a creator. You know why? Because she left out God's instructions, and she left out spiritual knowledge or spiritual understanding, or however you want to phrase that concept. There is a spirit world, brethren. We are just not physical beings. The things we're going through in life are an analogy of spirituality that we're going to inherit later. There's all kinds of analogies and sermons in that. She left out the spiritual knowledge that God gave her, which was, don't eat that, you're going to die. Just because something can be done, and just because something looks okay, and just because something tastes good, and just because it's okay to sensations, does not mean that the result is going to be good. Ask your mom and your dad if you don't believe me. A lot of things I've done that I thought were right that weren't. Kick yourself in the head. Can't change it. You know, and the thing is, this is the same technique that is used by science today to prove that there's no need for a God. The scientific method is the method that has given us the acceptance of abortions, homosexuality, infidelity. It's okay to play around. It actually spices up your married life. As I have read in scientific journals, by men who have several letters and initials after their names, because they've left out the spiritual facet of understanding of knowledge. It's given us the acceptance of infidelity and animalistic behavior. After all, if we descended from the animals, there's nothing wrong with acting like one, is there? Of course not. After all, we're only animals. I just read you some articles a while ago said it's okay to do those things. I'd like to read you a couple of quotes out of a college textbook that I used a few years ago. It was entitled Vertebrate Life, And I want you to think about what this is saying, and this is what you're being taught, or your children are being taught, our society is being taught, and we accept these things, and I mean society, we accept these things, and it fashions our thought processes. Humans are great apes, close relatives of chimpanzees and gorillas, and much of the biology of humans is best understood in the context of our vertebrate heritage. If we descended from the monkeys, it's only good to study the monkeys, and that'll throw light on how we should act. But what if we didn't descend from the monkeys? Then it has no bearing on us at all. Another one. How very different would have been the vast sweep of post-Triassic vertebrate evolution, and how altered would be the face of the earth today if the little late Triassic mammals had proven vulnerable to some contemporary reptilian predator and had relinquished the scene completely to the reptiles. In other words, the only reason you're here is because the little mammals that lived during the Triassic were able to escape the predatory dinosaurs and evolve into you. And if they hadn't have done that, you wouldn't be here. Back to my original question. God created us. We are the children of God. We are not created by some unintelligent process through a random set of circumstances. God created our parents, Adam and Eve. Eve means the mother of all things. God created everything, things visible and things invisible. We are the children of God physically now, and later we'll be the literal spiritual children of God. We call each other brethren. We're in the church, the mother. God the Father, we're going to be married. God the Son, we're going to be married to Him. God the Father is going to come down, and all of those terms are family. We're going to be born into the family of God. God is our Father, not evolution. Why does the world have so many problems? They don't know their origins. They don't know where they've come from. And if you don't know where you've come from, you certainly don't know where you're going.